Can I ask one question real quick? We'll do introductions, but there is a call-in with just a number. Is that somebody or is that just a public line?
It's a public line.
Okay.
Had to have.
Thank you. So I think we can go around and introduce
we
ourselves.
We can check with our
and,
team. Yeah. Okay.
Mike, did you want to start?
Yeah, sure. It's March 26, 2021. This is collective bargaining between the University of West Florida Board of Trustees and the United Faculty of Florida chapter of at the University of West Florida. And I'm Mike Matamore. I have nothing more to say.
All right, I'm Dan Lucas.
Jonathan Fink.
Remy Goujon.
Jamie Sprague. Chastity Hobbs.
Dean DeVoe.
I guess that's everyone. I don't know if there's anybody on the public line or not. They're muted anyway. So you're on the public line, but you can't speak. So we have some things to share with you today, Jonathan, with you and your team, for your consideration. I didn't want to jump right into it if you had something else that you wanted to talk about first.
No, I mean, we have a few things also, but the only thing I wanted to clarify, I forgot to mention last session, is just to make sure to record on the tape. Our bargaining team for this year, for this reopener, is myself, Dean DeBolt, Raid Amin, Emily McCann, who's our service unit director from UFF, and Chastity Hobbs, right? So that's the extent of our team. Raimi and Justin, Raimi is our UFF president, and Justin as our grievance officer, they'll be attending sessions, and you know, we'll ask them to participate from time to time if there's elements or expertise, but they're not bargaining agents for the university. So we just want to make sure and clarify that. So I forgot.
All right, thank you, Jonathan. We appreciate that. All right, well, you can go first or we can go first, but we thought that maybe the topic we take up because of its time sensitivity would be an extension of the memorandum of understanding on the COVID impacts.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, go ahead. That sounds great.
Okay. So we have a document that if Gabby could share with you and your team, however she goes about doing that. I don't know if she emails it to you or if she posts it somehow, but Gabby, could you post or circulate in some fashion the Memorandum of Understanding COVID-19 Health Emergency?
It's start circulating now.
I have it in front of me. That's great. Mike, if you want to walk through the proposal you guys are making.
Okay, good. So this is built upon the previous memorandum of understanding. Paragraph one, which is an introduction, stays the same. Paragraph two, which recognizes the collective bargaining agreement, intellectual property law, both federal and state, is applicable to new course content or course delivery materials created as remote instruction mandated by. Are you following me with this, John? Or
yes, yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay, good. In response to COVID-19. Three, just recognizes the option of excluding the fall 2020 semester course evaluations from use in preparing annual evaluations. If faculty decide to exclude teaching evaluations, they should include other evidence of teaching effectiveness. So there's no change through those paragraphs. We strike the pre-existing paragraph 4, and we add language that recognizes that faculty members should document the effects of COVID-19 on their ability to conduct or present scholarship, creative activities, and research for the, I guess that's, it says 21, what is that date, Dan?
It looks like just a typo. Is it just supposed to be 2020,
2021? I think that's right. So let's make a note of that. Five remains the same. Five has to do with where people have experienced losses because of non-refundable travel cancellation. And so that remains unchanged. Six, previously stated that the mandatory closure of university research facilities shall not negatively impact 2021 evaluations, SP, tenure, promotion. The fact that members shall document such impacts. We replace that language with language that says and recognizes the fact that members should document the impacts of mandatory closing of university research facilities for their annual evaluation, tenure, promotion, or SBE files. Seven remains the same. Seven has to do with faculty in high-risk categories who are able to self-identify and work remotely where possible. Eight, we replace the pre-existing language with this statement. The parties recognize that at the appropriate time, the university may transition to pre-COVID attendance on campus prior to the governor rescinding the declaration of the public health emergency. The parties acknowledge the fact that they have a duty to perform work on campus based upon the needs of the university. When the university transitions to pre-COVID attendance on campus, faculty will report back to their on-campus work assignments as instructed. Nine, we make a bit of a change here. Nine allowed for the option of extending the time clock for a tenure application by 1 year. And we're continuing that unless a faculty member has already exercised this option under the prior MOU, which was executed on April 28, 2020. So someone who has not today extended the time clock for a tenure application by 1 year has the ability to do that. What we're kind of concerned about is having someone who's already extended the tenure clock by a year to extend it by another year, which then pushes out tenure beyond this period by 2 years. The rest of the language in that section remains the same. Ten, we strike about continuing to comply with the requirements of the Family First Coronavirus Response Act and that human resources available to provide information as to how the Corona Response Act may apply, because the Corona Response Act, I believe, has expired. Isn't that right, Jamie?
Yes, it expired December 31st, 2020.
Yeah.
Mike, can I ask a quick question on that one?
Absolutely, sure.
And Jamie, you probably have the answer to this. So the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, was that part of the previous CARES Act?
No, it was a separate act in and of itself, and it allowed for that extended FMLA and for emergency paid sick leave. The extended FMLA was for the closure of a school or a daycare, and that expired in December.
Okay. Do you know, is there something similar to that that was included in the recent package that was the federal package that you know of that had a similar component?
No, there's nothing included in the, they're more focused on COBRA subsidies and different avenues like that, more financial impact. So.
Okay. Thanks, Jamie. That's helpful. Go ahead, Mike.
Finally, in paragraph 10 was paragraph 11, but is now renumbered. Again, we had a one-time option to postpone SPs by 1 year. We're going to continue to allow that to occur under this memorandum if an individual has not already exercised their option under the prior MOU of April 28, 2020. To exercise and postpone SP by a year. So if you have not postponed the SP prior to this memorandum in furtherance of the April 28th, 2020, you can still do that. And again, we recognize that this one-time postponement shall not constitute the use of the one-time postponement option that currently exists in the collective bargaining agreement. So it's above and beyond that. So that's our thoughts on modifying the memorandum on COVID to bring us up to date.
Okay. Thank you all for the time and the proposal. We'll absolutely take this back to faculty and get their thoughts on it. I have a few questions just kind of going through. I think I understand that our team will, if they have any questions as well. A couple questions I have, I'll just kind of go through it. In number 3, where it says, if faculty decide to exclude teaching evaluations, they should include other evidence of teaching effectiveness. We already have language in our CBA that says faculty are required to include at least one example, a teaching exemplar, in addition to the providing the students about course evaluations, right? So that's already a requirement for the CBA. Would this be additional material in addition to the 1 year? Additional material in addition to the one additional exemplar that's already required by the CBA?
Yeah, I think what we're trying to get at, and if you're looking at 3, which is unchanged, I think what we're looking at is that if someone has excluded the semester course evaluation for fall 2020, we think that it is incumbent upon faculty member to provide other evidence of teaching effectiveness. And I think it's above and beyond what's in the collective bargaining agreement. I think we want to open that up so that there's a more robust ability to say, you know, this is what I did during this period of time in which there was disruptions to how we go about researching and teaching. And so for the teaching component, which would be in under 3, let's say if somebody were to say, I created an online course, I converted my course to online, I converted my course to hybrid, I took on additional students because a course was canceled because you know somebody was sick. I think that's what we're kind of getting at. kind of more documenting for people today and documenting for people that might be looking at it in the future how you were impacted.
Yeah, and I think that we definitely understand the rationale. What I'm trying to get a handle on is how this additional requirement would relate to the additional requirement that already exists in the CBA, and trying to find clarification about the relationship between the already existing element and this new element that's added in. It I'm not sure, Mike, if the document you have in front of you is a color document or not. It looks like to me that the language about adding in additional material, it's in red in my document. So it looks like it's new language that's been added. And the documents on our screen here, if faculty decide to exclude teaching evaluations, they should include other evidence of teaching effectiveness. That's in red on my document in 3. So that looks like it's new additional language.
I don't have a color code in front of me, but I will. I think I can pull it up.
But it's okay. We can, when we review it, we can in our follow-up proposal, we can provide language that attempts to clarify the relationship between this requirement and the language that exists about additional requirements in the CBA.
You're right, Jonathan. I just pulled it up on my iPad, and it is in red, which would indicate that sentence, the second sentence of 3, is new.
Okay. We'll look at that. We may provide some language about to kind of clarify that relationship to what exists requirement already in the CPA.
Right.
In four and six, could you talk us through a little bit of the rationale about changing the language that previously said that it shall not negatively impact, that these impacts shall not negatively impact their evaluations, to a less binding statement about just saying they should document these effects? Like the new language that you guys have proposed to replace this with removes the language that clarifies that this shall not have negative effects on their evaluations.
Right. So what we are doing is we're opening this up a little bit and not having the assumption that there's been such negative impacts that a person would not be able to be have a reliable evaluation. That was what we committed to in our last memorandum of understanding. It's a presumption, both in 4 and 6. The presumption in 4 has obviously to do with, as you know, scholarship, creative activities, and research, and 6 has to do with the closure of research facilities. What we would suggest at this point in time is that there be information provided as to how an individual faculty member might have been adversely impacted, rather than a presumption that they were adversely impacted.
Okay, I appreciate the thoughts on that. We'll review this and get that to faculty as well for their thoughts.
I mean, at some point, I think we feel, and anyone can jump in, but I also see this as a trend throughout the state university system, which is at some point we're going to have to start moving toward life as it existed before the pandemic, and to know specifically on a case-by-case basis how what's happening today is impactful. I think it's going to be better for the evaluator and the supervisor and the faculty member to be able to work their way out of this than just a presumption blanket that it's adverse and ineffective for all.
Absolutely. And I think the faculty across the board are looking forward to transitioning back to normal. I think all of us, as I heard someone say, away from our 2D life back into our 3D life. So I think that's understood. But we'll look at the language of that and see what potential changes or any other elements we might propose. The language about the what's in 8 specifically. Now, so the language that we previously talked about in the last MOU related to the public health emergency, that language is still current. As far as I know, the governor has continued to extend that initial state of emergency, and that we're still under that state of emergency that is binding to that MOU. We had included that language simply just to memorialize that. I know certainly that faculty are committed to, as long as we are under that state of emergency, to having that ability to self-report and to work remotely under that state of emergency. You would probably, Mike, because he does work with the governor. I would imagine that state of emergency is not going to be extended out significantly longer. That, just as you said, we're transitioning back in some ways, that state of emergency will probably be transitioning back here pretty soon as well. So I feel pretty certain that faculty will want that material to remain as it's been identified about the state of emergency.
Well, the state of emergency, covers much, and it may remain in place for a long time because it could have some sort of necessity of existence because of a fiscal impact or how continued federal funds are allocated. For example, I know that the governor has mentioned, and I guess this is sort of in furtherance of this situation, that he's going to give a bonus to first responders. And I guess that would include first responders that work for the state. So there's a lot of reasons for that emergency order to be in place. And I think it's going to continue. And I think it's going to be modified. I don't have any inside information, but I believe that state universities and the Board of Governors are looking at a more active in-person presence, either in summer C or in the fall. And we're going to get some direction on that, I'm sure. And what we're suggesting is that if that happens, if the declaration is not revoked, if that happens, if we get word that we're to transition to a more active on-campus presence, we're still going to commit to 7, paragraph 7. So that would mean that if somebody feels as if they're in a high-risk category, they still can self-identify and work remotely where possible. But if we move toward vaccinations and students being vaccinated, and I think we're going to see a greater presence on campus. I believe yesterday, did the governor say that by some date in April, he's lifting all age limits over 18, I think.
At Monday, April 5th, anyone 18 and older can get vaccinated.
Yeah.
And this week is 40 and over. This week is 40 and over, and Monday starts the 18 and over.
Ramey and I both signed up this morning as 40-somethings. So, yep.
I'm fully vaccinated.
Well, Mike, I would say that you may have received your COVID vaccination. I can't verify that you're fully vaccinated.
That's true. I'm not fully vaccinated. I actually have several vaccines that I could probably use.
Yeah. So on the MOU, so on retaining that language in 7, it says faculty will be permitted to self-report in high-risk categories, but then having the language that says they'll be required to come to campus, I mean, that's going to present a potential conflict about the right of a faculty member to self-report or if they have to return to campus, right?
So I think that's a good point. I think we probably could work on that language.
Yeah, because they, you can imagine a scenario, right, where we're still under the state of emergency that governs the language at the top of 7 and someone's self-reporting, and then there's all simultaneously a requirement to come back to campus. We'll look at it, and we appreciate the
Mike, can I clarify that just a little bit?
Sure.
Jonathan, number 7 allows a person who feels like they're in the high-risk category that needs to work remotely can do so, and they'll still go through a process with HR, even if we move towards a repopulation of campus in the late summer or, you know, fall term. That's not going to change. So I'm not following you think there's a conflict statement. So could you explain that just a little bit better?
Sure, absolutely. So in 7, it says, let's see. Well, hang on. Here's this may be the problem. I think some of this language in 7 has been changed, but it's not identified in red. That where it says the university, I could be wrong, but where it says the university has been actively permitting faculty in high risk categories. Let me see if I have, I don't have the previous MOU in front of me.
We allowed that prior to this MOU getting signed last time. So I had faculty who identified as a high risk employee prior to this MOU being signed last year. So
yeah, no, I mean, my question is just really is wondering of what 7 is shown in all black language.
Dan,
here,
correct me if I'm wrong, but we did not make any changes to 7, correct?
I can't say with 100% certainty that it were, some didn't change, but I think the general paragraph is the same. As far as content, as far as I know.
So it says the university will continue this practice for a period of time not to exceed the effective period of the declaration unless earlier revoked or extended, right? So under this language that the faculty are permitted to report in high risk categories, right? And they've been to self-declare report in high risk categories. In the new language where it says, the parties acknowledge that faculty have a duty to perform work on campus based upon the needs of the university. I would understand that language to be a directive that faculty are required to report to campus in the extent that would be prior to the governor rescinding the declaration of a public health emergency, right? So this new language would require a faculty member to report to the university. They have a duty to perform work on campus at the direction of the university, even if that state of emergency is still in effect. So that would be the potential conflict.
Jonathan, that is correct. If we move to the pre-COVID, what this says, you would be required to report to wherever your teaching capacity is on campus, if you're an on-campus facilitator, okay? There are always options that we have in HR, whether it's through number 7 as the high risk or through ADA, that a faculty member can identify that I have X, the physician has signed off on it, and I need to work remotely. So that's how that would work. The requirement will be that all staff and faculty report, but there's always caveats on how, if the faculty feels they need to work remotely, we'll have a process in place for that to happen. So I just wanted to let you know that.
Okay, I appreciate the clarification. We'll review it and look back through.
Have that sentence need to be reworked to include that that right of faculty.
Yeah, absolutely, Dean. Yeah, we'll review it, and we appreciate the thoughts and have it on there. The only other question that comes to mind, I'm kind of going through just to make sure that we're clear. So I understand the proposal that the university is not providing a second year of tenure clock, but they're extending the deadline that in case someone has not provided that, they have not elected to utilize that yet, they would have more time in which to utilize that 1 year extension. The way in which this worked initially is we didn't have a deadline in this MOU. That we said the university had more leeway in determining that deadline for how long faculty had to exercise that option. Here, and so what the university, I think that deadline, I just looked this up the other day, ends in the next month or so is when that deadline ends. There has not been a new deadline put here in the MOU. It might be helpful, I think, to articulate that deadline. If there's an extension of that deadline, clarify that deadline will, that option will, you know, extend until, you know, like May 1st, 2022 or something like that. That we might want to memorialize that extension deadline in the
MOU. Yeah, we didn't have a deadline. We just kind of have a statement that says the university will establish a procedure and timetable for the exercise of the option. But if you want to, you know, negotiate that, we certainly are open to that.
Okay. I think that answers all of the question that I have. I appreciate the time and the consideration on these items. For our team members, was there anyone else who had questions about the MOU that you wanted to ask?
No, you covered it for me, John.
Oh, okay, sounds great. Thank you, Mike. Did you have, and we'll get this to faculty and collect their thoughts and have a proposal. I think there's a path forward on this, certainly.
I did want to add one thing on the MOU that I didn't hear come up. As you contemplate, returning it back. I do know that there was an element of accreditation and the need to document for accreditation involved in some of the requests for documentation. So just keep that in mind. That's all.
Could you say that again, Dan? I'm not sure about when you say for accreditation, like on the departmental level, or who would be doing this documenting? Or
I think just the request that we have for additional documentation, I think would support accreditation, you know, across university, in departments, wherever, than just kind of a blanket COVID kind of treatment of things. So I think that's also a factor in what we're trying to provide.
That makes sense. I appreciate it. Thanks, Dan. Mike, did you guys have other things that you had for us today?
Yeah, we do have a couple of other things. We have an Article 14, and I want to introduce it for a brief second. What we have at Article 14 is currently the act of a layoff. And we have a layoff is a management right, but we've negotiated around that management right a process where people can kind of know, they get notice, they get consideration, they understand what their status is, they have recall rights, and that's a good thing. So what has happened over the last year, what has come up in a couple of places is that universities, and I don't know of a single instance in which a faculty member was involved in this, but some universities utilized short-term furloughs in order to meet a particular economic need. And a furlough is probably, I think a furlough is a management right too. Those places that had furloughs had furlough policies or put out furlough policies. What we want to do is rather than address it that way, we would prefer to bring it up at the table and have a discussion about what a furlough would look like, what the process would look like to negotiate furloughs with you, or the furlough process with you, rather than just take it as a one-off act, or instead of having a policy that was put out. So we have modified Article 14 in two ways, but the primary way is that we are adding language for negotiations on the process of a furlough should we ever need to have one. So Gabby, if you could share with Jonathan and his team what we're proposing for Article 14.
Article 14 has been disseminated.
I'm sorry.
I've got it, Mike. I'm reading it.
Okay, good.
Did you want to walk through you said in addition to adding in furlough language, there was a second element that you've also?
If you turn to, section 14.5, and this is a change as it would relate to the layoff, not a furlough. So right now, there's an alternative equivalent employment process for when there's a layoff that's not effective. And it's not effective because it has the university making a reasonable effort, whatever that means, it's a pretty ambiguous term, a reasonable effort, to locate appropriate alternate or equivalent employment for a laid off faculty member. So I think alternate or equivalent is problematic too, because someone at the university, I'm not going to pick on human resources, but somebody at human resources with somebody who's been laid off might not know what kinds of vacancies a particular employee would be interested in taking. I mean, there may be a vacancy that is a different skill set, maybe a vacancy that has a different compensation level. And so what we thought we would do is give the information in this process of what is available for vacancies to the employee, allow them to have that access, let them identify the range of positions that are vacant that they would like to have, and then we would go through an analysis of their qualifications to see if, in fact, that would work. So clearly, when someone is laid off, it's in the university's best interest to find another placement for a whole lot of reasons, both economic and personal. And we think that can best be achieved if the employee starts with the information on what's available vacancy-wise and qualifications required for that vacancy, and then allow the employee to have the opportunity to identify, rather than just have someone kind of almost in a vacuum looking at vacancies and kind of guessing at what an employee would accept or not accept. So anyway, we took a stab at that process, and we'd like to have a discussion about whether there's a better way to do that than what's currently in contract.
Uh, Okay, I don't want to interrupt you, Mike. I'll jump in with a couple of just quick questions.
Sure.
So first of all, like, we appreciate you bringing the furlough material into bargaining. I think that's absolutely the right impulse and the instinct to do that, and as a term and condition of employment to negotiate. So we'll absolutely go through that and look through that material. We don't have to take the time today to go through all the details, because we're going to sit down, we'll read it closely, and come in with questions on it. Alternative equivalent employment, just as a consideration as I look at this initially, there's a difference between the way that the language exists now, which says they're going to make a reasonable effort to locate appropriate alternate or equivalent employment. There's a difference in the language of making an effort to locate appropriate alternate employment versus providing the faculty member instructions on how to access and view available job openings, right? So, like, I would read this that the current obligation of the university under the contract is to attempt to locate appropriate alternate or equivalent employment, right? Those may not be already expressly articulated job openings, right? Like someone may be in, you know, an apartment there, and then the university is looking for alternate employment at the university that may not coincide with an existing job opening. Here, this new language would potentially narrow that obligation of the university, and they would just say, well, the university could potentially say there's no appropriate alternate or equivalent employment because there are none that are currently listed as job offerings, right? So just looking at it initially, I think that would be a concern for faculty about the process through which the university is trying to retain that faculty member through finding them appropriate or alternate or equivalent employment.
You know, that's an interesting thought. I don't know if you've ever had a layoff at the University of West Florida. I'm not aware of one. Where I have been involved in layoff actions at other state universities, I believe those universities read for this provision to mean that they look to employment opportunities through vacancies. I don't think any. I'm not aware of anybody that would say we're going to create a job post layoff for you. I think it all is going through available opportunities that exist post the layoff. I don't know, Jamie, if you have any thoughts on that either, but I think that's how the process has worked where I've seen a layoff.
Since I've been here, we've not laid off any faculty. But if we came to a point that we had to lay off faculty, we definitely would look at vacancy openings, regardless if they're recruiting on the page up system. So even if we had to list those like somewhere on the academic affairs or the HR website, we would do that prior to the layoff so that you would have knowledge and instructions on whichever website you need to look at, plus how to get into page up to look at whatever is being recruited at the time. That's my thought process. If we need to articulate that a little bit better, then please feel free to, you know, edit that language that we have in there.
Okay, that sounds great. We'll go through that, and we'll also just kind of reach out to some of our resources and see at other universities who have potentially gone through layoffs of faculty, what that process entails. So yeah, we'll look at that closely. Thank you, Jamie, for doing that. Okay, well, for my teammates, did you guys have any other questions about the furlough language or this change to the layoff?
Well, the only thing I can think of is the furlough, the first 14.2, when the new language says the university experiences a significant budget reduction, okay? And I can understand that. I think everybody can appreciate that, a major deficit. But then buried down here within it, it also says, if the president determines it is necessary for the financial health and stability or specific unit of the university, they can permit a unit to do this. And I'm a little more troubled by that because that seems to me a much broader way of just, you know, arbitrarily wiping out divisions and departments and that kind of thing. I mean, I can appreciate the catastrophic event in reduction in funding, but I think number three kind of concerns me that it may perhaps give the president a little bit too much power to prune and trim at will. So I think we'll need to look at that.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think what we'll do is review some of the furlough policies that have been implemented or the other language in this. Mike, did you have comments on Dean's questions about the implementation of furloughs on a unit level or on a unit level rather than a university-wide level?
No, not really, but I mean, that's something we can have a discussion about. Like if a furlough is implemented, how one would identify the persons impacted, yeah.
Mike, can you?
Okay.
I have a question. Mike, could you address why you want to change the language that the union would not be informed about furloughs? Only in the case of layoffs.
Well,
because every union we're gonna get those kind of requests from our members at some point if that were to occur.
I mean, I think that's a good point, Dean, and I think that's, you know, we certainly would entertain language in the contract that would involve advance notice to the United Faculty of Florida in the event there was a furlough.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for asking that, Dean. Yeah, that was something I was gonna ask you about too. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so Mike, thank you for providing this. We'll take this back and look at it and get a response to you shortly.
Yeah, hopefully we never have a furlough or a layoff, but in the event what happens, let's have a common understanding of how the practice would roll out. All right, we have one other thing that it's not a negotiable item necessarily, it's an informational item that we can proceed with, or if you want to give us something else first, it's fine with us too.
I'm gonna send some things to Gabby that are from us. We have about 35 minutes left. I imagine that we'll probably need 20, 25 minutes for the proposals that we have. Is the informational item something that's pretty quick, Mike? Or?
Well, it's something that I'm going to have Gabby send you, and it's just something that you can look at if you have something that you want to respond to us about it. We can do it another time, but what we drafted up was a frequently asked questions document on phased retirement for people who may be considering this option. And before we roll it out, we wanted to share it with you and get your feedback.
Perfect, that's great. That's actually on our list of things to discuss today. And the CBA has language that says we'll develop those items together. And so we would be happy to review that. And thank you for bringing that up. I think Gabby is supposed to do that. Yeah, so I've got that from Gabby now. We'll review this. What is the university's position on on us providing feedback to the university? Would that constitute bargaining this document? I mean, this is not something that has to be ratified.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not something. Yeah, it's not language that's going to go into the contract. So I don't think it's really collective bargaining.
Yeah.
But we drafted this up, and we want your take on it. So, however you want to respond. Great.
We'll review it, and if we feel like there are elements that may touch on the questions are about just the parameters of the program itself that may need to be documented in bargaining, we'll bring that back into bargaining, just for clarification.
Okay.
But if it's something that, you know, we can certainly review it, and if it looks fine, we'll send it out as well. We'll be in touch, but our discretion will be to bring it. Our default will be to be, you know, overly cautious and bring it back into bargaining since it was presented here in bargaining if need be.
Okay.
So, thank you for doing that. We'll I've got that now. I sent Gabby a few items. Gabby, did you receive those?
Yes.
Okay. So what we have today is one of the things that we thought would be helpful maybe to focus on during this session is that there's several elements of related to these promotion structures that are in different elements of completion right now that we think that these would be good elements to focus on to try and complete in our reopener. None of these elements have immediate financial impact on the university, and they would have other ancillary benefits, which we'll talk about in a second. So to kind of go through them, I'm getting a little bit of an echo. Are you guys, can you hear me okay? Oh, okay, great. So going through these, If you look at the promotion proposal, the proposal itself is pretty simple. This is for part of the Article 25. This is not the complete Article 25. We recognize that we're still waiting on budgetary issues and these things. So this is not the, we will return to other elements of 25 potentially, but these are just for these specific elements of Article 25. What we have proposed is clarifying in the promotion increases. We've added in the position of associate clinical professor here into the 13% promotion for the associate level. Do you guys, has everyone have this in front of you? Yeah, okay, great. So associate clinical professor. And then on the second paragraph of the promotion, it's also 13%, but we felt like this was the appropriate place to add these positions. We've added the senior instructor, senior lecturer, senior research associate, and clinical professor. there's two MOUs that we've negotiated previously that relate to these positions. The clinical professor one, that's coming up, the opportunity for those faculty to go up for promotion is coming up quickly. That clinical professor MOU says that in the 2023 and 2024 year, that's when they're going to be eligible to go up for promotion. Mike, do you have a question?
No, I'm good.
Okay, good. So their clinical faculty, they're up in 2023, 2024 for the ability to go up. So that's the most pressing concern to kind of get some of these elements clarified in the CBA. For the instructors and lecturers, we signed the MOU last year where they are, we petitioned PERC for establishing those positions, but we have not have a timeline or a promotion percentage yet. We've included a second document here, which is an MOU procedure for the for the instructors and lecturers, right? And I'll get to that in a second. Please don't hesitate to stop me at any time as I'm kind of going through this if questions arise or you want me to clarify anything. We've also added in here language that would memorialize the Distinguished University Professorship. I've included, and this is something that's been ongoing at UWF. This is an established position. I've attached that this is an endowed professorship. And the last time that this was awarded was in 2017. So we've gone through about three different iterations. One element, as you notice, if you look in the documents from the PACE funds, is that this foundation, it funds the three-year program, and then the university, which we fully support, the university implemented a element that once they complete this three-year program successfully, that $7,500 stipend converts to base salary. Now, this is already converted to base salary for, I think we have six or seven current Distinguished University professors. Our thought on this is that it's valuable to memorialize that this element of the Distinguished University Professorship and that endowment specifically here in the CBA, because it our position is it goes beyond just being an award, but is a position. So we think it should be memorialized here in the CBA. So that's the proposal. I'm going to talk a little bit about how the ancillary and additional benefits of this, but I want to, if there's any questions that you guys have about this proposal itself, I'd be happy to answer those.
Does anybody on the team have any questions for Jonathan?
Jonathan, you said the last time the Distinguished Professor was awarded was what year? I didn't hear you. You broke up just a little bit.
2017.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was awarded like 2004, maybe 13, 15, and 17. Each time there were, you know, two people. And we're not proposing any changes to any of those structures, just to memorialize it in the contract.
Okay, anybody else? All right, we're good.
So the promotion rollout MOU, this is exclusively for the senior lecturer, senior instructor, and the senior research associate. And this says that, so no senior lecturer, senior instructor, or senior research associate would be eligible to apply for this promotion prior to the 2024-2025 academic year. So this is the year after the clinical professors have already been negotiated eligibility to go up, right? So what's already in line are the clinical professors going up 2023-2024, having the opportunity to. This would be the year after that would be the first year of eligibility for the lecturers, instructors, and research associates. And then because there's certainly more lecturers, instructors, and research associates than the clinical faculty, we agree that it's appropriate to have a rollout schedule among that current population as well. For example, when we negotiated the SPE process, right, we had a rollout MOU for that, for the rollout program. It's pretty standard practice when these sort of new things are implemented that you have a rollout program negotiated. So what we're proposing is that in the first group of 2024-2025, the eligible instructors, lecturers, and research associates would have 15 years of service or more. The next year would be 10 years of service or more. And then beginning in 26-27, it would be fully online with, you know, anyone who's eligible depending upon the criteria at that point. So this is the rollout schedule that we think would be hopefully be amenable to the university.
Okay, thanks, Jonathan. Does anyone have any questions, Jonathan, about that proposal? Yeah, I don't either. Okay.
So, and if I can too, so one additional element to kind of talk about is I think that there's a benefit, our team thinks that there's a benefit in this, that it actually helps us to resolve some of the issues that we've been discussing previously in bargaining. So one of the things to think about, the way that our collective bargaining agreement and the tenure and promotion criteria coexist is that the collective bargaining agreement has language in both the tenure article and the promotion article that directs the university through its, you know, committee structures and whatnot to create tenure and promotion criteria, right? So our tenure and promotion criteria document is created outside of bargaining, but it's directed from bargaining and the CBA to create those guidelines. When you look at our tenure and promotion criteria, there's two elements to promotion criteria. You have the university criteria, and these are pretty much just based on annual value. The first bar to be eligible for tenure and or promotion, you have to be maintaining a certain level of annual evaluation. Then there's language within the TNP criteria that says departments can create enhanced criteria, right? That is specific to that department that the faculty member also has to meet, right? This is what takes more time and why it's important, I think, to get some of this material and a timeline lined out is for departments to be able to create that enhanced criteria. This is the sort of things where a department may say, you know, we expect you to have published in these specific journals or to publish this specific type of thing or to have these kinds of grants available. But these are the department specific requirements that are the enhanced criteria. So one of the elements that we've had lots of conversation about is the process by which tenure and promotion criteria, broadly bylaws, but specifically tenure and promotion criteria, is created on the departmental level and approved on the departmental level, right? When you open up the tenure and promotion guidelines and criteria, you'll notice in there, it says that departments, and I'm just reading, this is from this, you know, departments can exercise more stringent performance requirements than the university standards as described in part one, right? So it goes on from that saying that departments have the right to do the enhanced criteria. So underneath that, it says changing departmental standards, right? This is all it says. When departments choose to change or enhance their standards, the University Faculty Personnel Committee must review these proposed changes. Changes in departmental standards must be consistent with the applicable provisions in the collective bargaining agreement, right? So right now, in the tenure and promotion guidelines, the only process for reviewing the departmental enhanced criteria, which is the material that's in the bylaws, is to have the UPC review it, right? If this would be the place that for us to resolve some of these issues about the approval process for tenure and promotion criteria, as the university through its committees goes in to make these clarifications about the requirements for instructors and lecturers and research associates in the tenure and promotion guidelines, this would also be the place where they would say, when departments make changes to enhance their standards, the review process needs to go through these specific steps, right? This is the place where the university, you could simultaneously articulate a fuller process rather than just the UPC, if the university believes that that process needs to be a fuller process, and this would also comport with the requirements of the collective bargaining agreement. This is an issue that we've had a lot of conversation about, and on this narrow component of it about tenure and promotion criteria is a clear path to resolve some of those issues, I think that would be amenable to both of our teams. So that's the additional benefit, is as we clarify these elements about the promotion structure, we can also move into making these same beneficial changes to the review process within the TNP guidelines, if that makes sense.
I understand. Anybody have any thoughts or questions? Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Jonathan. We appreciate what you provided today, and we'll certainly go through this and take that back into our discussion on how we are going to respond to these issues.
Okay. And I think that's everything that we have today as well. I would ask, when you brought phased retirement, Jamie, I don't know if it would violate any, let us know if it'll allowed to answer this, but do you know the status of like how many people have expressed an interest in this phased retirement? I know I've had at least probably 6 or 7 faculty who've reached out to us who were interested in participating in this.
I've had 4. Only one has executed the paperwork.
Okay. Okay. Sounds good. Okay. But that's, do we want to schedule probably pretty quickly? So we, for the COVID-19, we probably want to get that back to you guys pretty quickly.
Okay. What do you think?
You know, we're missing a couple members of the team right now on our end.
So okay.
It may work better if we kind of give you some dates and do that by email right after the meeting.
Yeah, that's fine. I the 14th that 14th through the 16th, I'm going to be out of town in April, but just about any other time, we should be pretty flexible.
All right. You said the 14th through what? I'm sorry.
14th through the 18th, that it's like that Wednesday through the weekend.
Okay.
No, my team, was there anything else? Dean or Chastity or Raymer, anybody?
Not I.
All right. Well, happy vaccinating and we'll give you those dates as soon as we can.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay. Guys,
thanks.
Where is your second dose? Second dose is a doozer.